how about we don't try and make food perfect, because it's not perfect, just like life's not perfect.
If you're recycling, that's awesome. But you also need to look at all these other pieces, and you don't have to be doing them perfectly.
The first step is reduce, then reuse, then recycle. They are in order.
Get inspired by people fighting to make this world better for everyone. This is Unwasted with Imperfect.
Hello and welcome back to the Unwasted Podcast. I'm your host, Riley Brock, and it's my honor every week to talk with experts in food, health, sustainability, and generally making the world a better, tastier place. We've all heard the phrase, health is wealth. We know that how we eat is one of the biggest things that determines how healthy we are. But it seems like eating healthy is such a moving target sometimes. There's new studies, trends, and diets coming out every week, and it can be really hard to separate fact from hype and misconception when it comes to the seemingly simple act of feeding ourselves. Why is it so hard to figure out how to eat? And how can we make healthy eating easier for ourselves? Our guest today is a medical student with a passion for sharing sound nutritional advice that helps all of us invest in our physical and mental health. I'm really excited for this conversation. Brooklyn Palmer, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
I am so excited to nerd out on food and nutrition with you. This is one of my favorite personal topics. And as I alluded to in the intro, something that seems to be almost impossible to master in the 21st century. It seems like there's new knowledge constantly. It's really a hard field to try to stay on top of. But I want to actually start with how you kind of got into being curious about food and nutrition, which I think is a pretty crazy story. As I understand it, you saw a documentary about gastric bypass surgery as a young person, and that really changed how you thought about food. Walk me through this. What sort of feelings and questions did this documentary bring up for you?
Absolutely. So I would love to note that it was actually the fact that the gastric bypass surgery was happening on a 12-year-old. I believe the age was 12. And
wow.
That's when it really hit me. I believe that as humans, we particularly react to children differently. You know, they have less choice in what they go through, in how they go through life and the choices that they make. And so when we are seeing issues in the children population, I think it's a really big reflection on the overall environment and what is going on in the world. And so that really made me frustrated. You know, I'm not an angry person. I really am not. But it really just perplexed me, you know, when we're looking at the side effects of not prioritizing lifestyle and eating behaviors in the medical community. You know, at that point, when I realized I wanted to go into medicine and focus on nutrition, I was about 17. I was like, wait a second, not a single doctor or anyone in healthcare had ever talked to me about food. And I thought that was so perplexing as I started to understand we have so much medical and health literature showing these connections. Naturally, nutrition is a tricky field to do research in, which we don't have to get into, but we have known for a long time that this really is the core of so many, especially chronic illnesses. And I was confused. I was like, wait a second. If we know have this information, why is this not being prioritized, particularly in the medical realm, which everything I'll be talking about will be more focused on the United States because that's where we're at and that's the communities that I want to focus with. But I just remember seeing this, remember learning that it disproportionately affected underserved communities and just being like, something has to change. We have to change as a healthcare system, as a community that looks at and views health and nutrition, or we're going to keep seeing these trends of, you know, people suffering at the end of the day. And that's just, I mean, at the end of the day, we all want to avoid it. But as you mentioned, it is complex. And there's some elements that are a little bit simple. It's kind of contradicting, but we'll get into that later, I'm sure.
You bring up a great point, which is that a canary in the coal mine of our healthcare system is the fact that kids are dealing with stuff like diabetes and getting gastric bypass surgeries. And, you know, if you're looking for a kind of red flag, to me, that would seem to be a really big one. So I definitely relate to what you're saying, seeing this documentary and realizing that, look, this is now children are dealing with what we used to define as kind of late adult metabolic disorders. It's wild. You know, so you mentioned something which I've heard from a couple other people, which is that nutrition is not wholly excluded, but kind of largely left out of medical education. I mean, you're a med student now, so I want to hear your take. How, if at all, is nutrition incorporated in your education?
So it's really interesting. I went into medicine for nutrition because there's a lack thereof of it, right? A lot of people ask me, why didn't you become a nutritionist, a dietitian? And to that, I say, I believe it's important to have people from all different perspectives and angles approaching this issue because we have to work as a team to move forward. That's what healthcare is, right? And for me personally, just being a big nerd, loving patient care, I was like, you know what? This is a track for me. So far in medical school, we've gone short and good nutrition knowledge, but what I've kind of noticed is that you can have amazing information and pass it on, but if you're not passing it on in a way that is going to be able to translate into applicable actions, that can only go so far. To give a good example, during our cardiology unit, we had 15-minute video that was not graded. And honestly, when you're going through this track, it's kind of like grades, you kind of associate that with like, okay, what should I put my time and energy on? You just kind of went through it. You know, they talked about fiber for about 30 seconds. It was all true. It was all facts. But if you didn't have a base understanding of nutrition, it probably would go in one ear and out the other. And I even asked some of my classmates this. I was like, did you get anything out of this? And they're like, honestly, not really. And so being biased, I have looked into nutrition for years. So of course I'll see material differently, but there really is an overwhelming amount of medical students at the end of the 4 years saying that they are not confident in their nutrition understanding. And there's actually a study published that showed that around 90% of cardiologists, which is a real shame if you ask me, do not feel like they had adequate nutrition training. And so what I really like to emphasize, especially to others and on my social media page, is that it's not necessarily inherently, you know, doctors just don't want to look into this. It really is not currently built into the healthcare curriculum. And that's one of the reasons why focusing on that, I think, is really valuable. There's a couple of days you can approach it. You know, you can empower the community. I really do think that there is space now, especially as there's this growing field of culinary medicine, that future healthcare providers can get this information in a better and more extensive way so we can bring that back to our future patients in the community.
That's super powerful, what you just said, that it's, and I appreciate you underlining that, that it's not that people don't care, they don't want to learn or teach this, it's just that it's not really built into the default program, so it's not getting emphasized. It's kind of like an afterthought, it sounds like. And I mean, just like thinking anecdotally here, like I don't think I've talked to my primary care physician once about my diet, which is funny. I mean, I guess maybe it hasn't been directly related to what I've gone to see my doctor for, but you think it would come up at some point. Like, what are you eating? Like, how are you sleeping? You know, kind of the basic stuff. But it's fascinating how that gets left out. I mean, you have some really awesome kind of musings and takes that you share on your social media page about nutrition in America. So I'm curious to hear your take on this. What are we currently getting wrong when it comes to nutrition in the U.S.?
I believe one of the main things we're getting wrong is an overemphasis on weight and not health. So many people, my peers included, really do have this strong association that weight equals health. And the reason why I believe this is such a disservice to others is that reasons for weight changes are very fluctuant, right?
Yeah.
Are you just trying to get thin for the summer? Are you comparing yourself to someone in social media? There are so many non-sustainable reasons to lose weight. And so if the base of your change in eating happens is focused on that, it's not going to be sustainable. And that's something I like to emphasize a lot. We talk about sustainability in the environmental sense, but I think it really needs to be prioritized in health as well. And this is why we see time and time again, there's a reason there's so many fad diets, is because they do not work and they are not sustainable.
Yeah.
And so this emphasis on diets, which again, you have to understand, companies, book writers, everything, they are able to make money when people get traction of these diets. And a lot of these diets are focused on weight. And I think that the more we focus on health, long-term health, preventative health, which is definitely easier said than done, I believe that that is really where we're going to start making waves. Not only to mention the mental side of it too, you know, going on diets can really be taxing on mental health and comparison and feeling like we're not doing well enough. And, but if you're focused on how you feel on the inside, how you want to feel down, you know, decades down the road, that's a much healthier and much more sustainable way to view health and eating.
I think that's huge. What you just said, that it's a treadmill that people get on of like diet and diet, diet. And in a way you end up kind of getting trapped chasing the wrong goal. It sounds like it's part of the problem, that because weight is not conducive to health. So if your goal is just to lose weight, you're never going to really maybe solve some of the underlying issues and actually how you're eating. You know, you alluded to something earlier that I think is huge and should get more attention in the media, but ironically, it doesn't because of how our media is structured. Why is it so hard to study nutrition scientifically? Because I think this is something the general public, myself included, has gotten caught up in that, well, it seems like the science never agrees. And one week they say red wine is good for you. The next week they say it's not. One week they say vitamin C is amazing. The next week they say it's overrated. What is it about nutrition science that makes it so hard to kind of have simple takeaways that people can just use and run with?
I think this is extremely valuable because there is so much information out there. And one of the reasons, which I'll try and condense them down, is the fact that some of these studies are paid for and supported by certain food companies. And it's really valuable to keep that in mind. You know, just because there's a study, just because there's research done, does not equate to this is completely objective, this is factual. It doesn't. And I think if you are not familiar with a research project, which process, which most people aren't, and like, why should we be? You know, we're not all going into research, but unfortunately there are, you know, different goals in mind. Not everyone who's running a research study's goal is to come out with something that's going to help people. It might be to sway people's interest in a certain product or a certain food group. Another reason why nutrition research can get a little muddled is different definitions. You know, they talk about low carb, you know, okay, so does that mean that everything else is a specific food, or you're just doing low carb and then you can just eat, you know, butter, you know, or something fried? Or there's a lot of different definitions and they're not always specified, but you can still get this research out and put it out into the public. And at the end of the day, the spiciest titles are going to be what people look at, and therefore news outlets want to produce these. There's actually, from my understanding, years ago, one talking about chocolate being healthy for you, and the person who made that, their entire goal was to prove that they could get a newsletter out there. And this should really just be a huge, huge warning to anyone listening. If there is a nutrition research study in the media, I really, really urge you to second guess the results, because you can also say results in different ways. And to finish up, another reason why nutrition is so hard is that unless you have research subjects in a facility and they're all eating the exact same thing, it's really hard to come to the conclusion that you want to come to. You can give people X calorie amount, but we know that it's not just calories. Every single person with that limit could be eating something different. And so just by the nature of how nutrition is, you know, versus a drug, you take the drug, you don't take the drug, or you take a placebo. It's very, you know, one or the other, but nutrition is just so, which that's a beauty of it, right? That's why I love it. But on the flip side, it means that, you know, the results that we see are not always able to make these strong claims that some people want to make.
Thank you so much for that answer. That I think that really helps kind of clarify some of this, which from the outside, especially if you're not trained in medicine or don't have a scientific background, can seem baffling and frustrating. I want to tease out two aspects of your answer because I think they're important and interesting in their own way. The first one is the science, which, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but part of my understanding is why the science is so hard to make into simple headlines is it's really easy to study a thing in isolation, like let's say a nutrient, right? Like vitamin E or vitamin D or whatnot. However, it's really hard to scientifically study it in the larger context of a actual dietary pattern of real people eating, sleeping, exercise. And it sounds like part of your point was you would literally have to have people in like a bunker where all they did was eat the exact same foods. And even then it would actually be really hard to isolate the variables. Am I getting that right or what am I missing?
Absolutely. And that's a really important point, is that food is not the sum of its parts. And I think that's something that gets lost a lot. When we break down food, our body reacts to it differently. If we're eating it with other food, our body reacts to it differently. You know, the more I go through medical school and I see all these insane hormonal biochemical pathways, it just becomes clearer and clearer that there are endless interactions, ones that we are not even familiar with. And the ones we are familiar with are extremely extensive. And so making any strong claim that one food or one nutrient is going to do X, Y, and Z really is just not, it's not going to be as accurate as we think. You know, we can, for instance, I was talking to a friend who's interested in research, like he was talking about like, oh, how does like the chemical components of apple affect cardiomyocytes, which are like the muscle cells in the heart. I was like, okay, yeah, that's really interesting. But when we consume an apple, A, it's not the sum of its parts. B, it goes through our digestive system. The nutrients get, you know, metabolized by the liver, and then maybe eventually it goes to the heart. And so it's, again, these really good intentions may not always be applicable in a realistic sense. And it's just really hard to hash that out, which again is just kind of the nature of nutrition.
Yeah, it sounds like so much of it is relational, like so much of it is what you're eating in relation to other things you're eating. I mean, two examples that come to mind for me are lycopene and turmeric. So as I understand it, lycopene is one of the really healthy compounds in tomatoes. It's great for you, but it's a lot more bioavailable if you eat it with something like with fat in it, especially like olive oil. It helps you actually metabolize the nutrients. So if one were to do a study on lycopene, but you didn't incorporate the olive oil, you would actually be kind of missing a key takeaway, which is, and this is something like, you know, for example, food cultures have figured out over hundreds and thousands of years that you should eat these two things together, or one does, you know, for a variety of reasons. And then another one I'm thinking about is turmeric here, which obviously we all know turmeric is super trendy and it's been used in Ayurveda medicine for thousands of years. But, you know, it's a powerful ingredient. It does have some healing properties, as I understand it. But it's a lot more active if you eat it with black pepper. Like the black pepper has a chemical or enzyme or something in it that makes the turmeric more bioavailable. So, I mean, I just bring up those examples because those are just two that come to my mind, and I know there's probably hundreds of thousands of more out there that aren't common knowledge. So anytime you're just shining a spotlight on one thing, it sounds like we could be missing all of the peripheral things around it that are actually making it happen.
That's a really important point. Not to mention the power of the brain. You know, the brain is able, the stress in your life, relationships, depression, that has actual chemical side effects as well. Again, things we probably don't even know. You know, I studied neuroscience in college because I thought it was so beautiful and so mysterious. And still to this day, there are so many times in my education when they're like, we still don't really know about this. And this is why it's so important that if someone's trying to make a claim about one little thing, I really don't encourage that. And something that I think is really important with social media, those who make the strongest claims are typically those who might not be as familiar with research, because the nature of research is to not make big claims. It's associations. We have different p-values. We have different proofs of how close things are, and nothing is 100%. That is just the nature of research. And guess what? When people don't understand research, and someone who, you know, is very understanding of research in the medical community, when they say things, it's going to come across as less sure because they are familiar with how just the body works. And for those who may not be in research, which of course these are just general claims, they can be like, this will change your life. This will equal this. This will make your immune system suddenly phenomenal. That is not how the body works. And again, that's the beauty of it. But it's also why we can't make claims like this. But those claims sell. They sell attention. They sell products. They sell views on social media. And it's really important that when someone is making a claim, you really need to ask yourself, what is their goal? Is their goal to educate me? To sell me a product, to get me to sign up to something. Not that everything is necessarily malicious, but it's important that different people, different information has different goals attached to it. And a lot more resources and voices are going to be put into the goals of trying to get you to buy something, because that's just kind of how the cycle goes, unfortunately.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. I mean, and you see this in the news, you know, a title like, you know, there was that big story a while back. It was like, oh, bacon is terrible for you. Like bacon will kill you. Or like on the inverse, like acai bowls will save you. Like that will quite literally get a study picked up and going viral. It'll get coverage by news outlets. You might get a book deal or a podcast deal or an Instagram page out of it. However, it's always going to be more nuanced than that. And that's something, that's something the public, I think, struggles with. And I don't want to get into COVID too much, but I will bring up that you saw this during the first couple months of COVID, that the public was getting frustrated that, oh, well, the scientists are changing their mind. And like they said this and now they're saying something else. Like they must not even know what's going on. When anytime I talk to a friend who has a background in science, they'll say, no, that's actually science is working how it's supposed to. It's like science is supposed to be gradual. It's supposed to be a process of arguments and testing hypotheses and arriving at new conclusions when the data suggests it, and not making bold claims that are just like, oh, this is the answer. Because often science is it's figuring out the answer. It doesn't know right now, and that's the point.
Yeah, and I absolutely don't blame people, right? I think our brains are set up. We like boxes. We like labels. We want a yes. We want a no. But when it comes to something as complicated as the human body, about a virus that we do not understand or a food product that we might not totally understand, you bring up a great point. You know, I was really frustrated the whole time, you know, seeing my medical, my science, my healthcare community get ridiculed when they, in a time where it was so risky to even do research, were putting their lives on the line to get answers.
Yeah.
But because their answers in a way that might not translate to those familiar and research, it may not make sense.
Yeah.
And so I think it is relevant because that was a very saturated version of something that goes on with nutrition over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. The COVID was like, because it was such a news story, we were all expecting updates daily or hourly when really this research usually takes years and we are expecting it to take weeks. And so, of course, there's going to be a lot of like, well, they don't seem to know, or well, they changed their mind. It's like, yeah, because you're asking them to do science at, you know, breakneck sprinter speeds here.
When I saw people being like, where's the vaccine we want it now? Vaccines and medications take years to study. Because
yeah.
Guess what? There could be side effects that we don't understand that could happen years down the road.
Yeah.
So honestly, if there was one within a month, I would be very concerned because you don't know how it affects people 2 months later. You
yeah.
know, we're doing our best. We are, you know, doing what we can, but it's very hard to predict something that we don't understand. And again, I think people think, you know, oh, virus binds to receptor, vaccine against receptor. Like, it is so, so complicated, especially when, yeah, the body's beautiful and that's why I went into medicine. But what makes it beautiful is that it's so, so not clear and not straightforward.
Yeah. One final thing I wanted to chat about was the media angle, because you alluded to this, and that's another side of this that I think is important to unpack, which is that the media selects for simple, bold, often provocative or outrageous headlines. That those will quite literally sell issues. They'll get clicks, they'll get views, they'll get likes, they'll get shares, all of that. So I think it's no accident that the headlines that are most widely known and get the most traction, the studies that get republished as news stories, always are going to be the most controversial. Like, you never see a CNN headline that's like, you know, breaking news, like, it's good to eat a lot of vegetables, even though everyone agrees. That's ironically the one thing we all agree on. However, if you will see articles that are like, red meat will kill you, red meat's not actually that bad, wine will kill you, wine's not actually that bad, green tea will save you, green tea is actually overrated, because like, that provocation is what will sell stories. Mm-hmm. And I think the chocolate study you bring up is really important. I'm going to throw it in the show notes. I want people to look into it, because in this example, someone literally trolled the whole scientific and media community successfully. And that was kind of the point, to show that, look, you can make up a headline, and as long as the headline is good enough, it will get traction. And this is something that I'll get off my soapbox in a second, but I read on Trust Me, I'm Lying by Ryan Holiday, which is a book all about media manipulation. And this was his exact point that has kind of stuck with me in a pretty sobering way since then, which is that, look, and we live in a sadly post-truth world where literally if your headline is sexy enough or outrageous enough, it'll get traction whether or not it is true, because it will get shares. And that's really unfortunate, but I think all of us have to look in the mirror and make peace with that. And to your point, I love what you said, be skeptical. We all should be skeptics, especially when it's stuff about our health and our nutrition.
People really need to understand the media, like any other business, is a business. And
yeah.
they are going to succeed the more people share their stuff, the more people view their stuff. Their goal is not to put the truth out there. That is just objectively not their goal. They want people to view their material. And it really is why I felt like getting into social media myself as someone in healthcare was so important. And, you know, some people kind of think it might not be the most ethical thing, but I think it's kind of the opposite. There's so many voices out there. If we can increase the voices of those who may understand these research processes a bit more, I think that we're just going to naturally be able to understand things better. You know, and you bring up a really good point about the eat vegetable things. I actually listened to a podcast forever ago, but they were someone who was on a media outlet. Here's the funny thing. So many people in the healthcare world, whether, you know, you eat meat, you're vegan, Mediterranean, there are some things that everyone agrees on, but the things that we don't agree on is what makes headlines. And that's
yeah.
why people get so confused and don't know what path to follow, is because the things that are, you know, put in your face are the exceptions. They're the side points. There's such a baseline of, you know, whole grains, more fruits and vegetables, less alcohol overall, maybe a little red wines, that, you know, 90% of those in nutrition agree with, but that 10%, that's the spicy stuff. Mm. And that's what news is pushing out. And so that's a really big point, is that while the human body is complex, there are some eating behaviors that are beautifully simple that we are not seeing on a global scale. And we're seeing that being correlated with health issues. And so to me, that's almost encouraging, is that we don't need the acai. We don't need the turmeric. They might be beneficial in certain ways. You know, different plant sources are good in a lot of different ways. But there are some simple steps that everyone can take that people are nearly going to be guaranteed that they will, you know, work towards preventing some of these ailments and just feeling better, which I think we all want to do.
Yeah. So let's dig into that. Like, cause this is, again, I think this should get more attention, and you seem to have an idea of where to go here. What are the things that nutritionists and healthcare professionals agree on when it comes to nutrition? Like, what are some of the principles we should just all be following?
So one principle, and we see this when we like study on like a very wide, angle, you know, meta-analysis, stuff like that, is lower consumption of sodium. And so this is what we see, especially because the thing about salt is that's kind of sneaky. You know, you'll have it in a prepackaged meal, it'll be 70% of your daily amount, but it won't taste salty. You know, as we move towards more and more convenient foods, one of the things that makes something convenient, which makes it shelf stable, is higher amounts of salt, because that's what, you know, keeps it preserved. And so as we see busier schedules, less cooking at home, we see more of these, you know, meals at restaurants, which also fall into this line, snacks, frozen meals that all have honestly kind of really concerning high amounts of salt. And I try not to demonize foods. I do think that that is not beneficial, but something that I think everyone agrees on is lowering some of these ultra processed foods. That's kind of what people call it, which even then I think people don't necessarily know what that means. And so when I say process, I mean kind of how far away is it from its natural source? You know, you can have a baked potato, or you can have very thin fried potato chip. You know, that baked potato is going to be closer to its actual source, which is the potato versus the chip. And that's a really, you know, general way of doing it. But that's definitely one thing people agree on. And also increasing fruits and vegetables. Yeah. It's sad because it sounds so simple, and yet we aren't seeing it. And I think it's because we get all these other things are so much more exciting, right? You know, can I take a turmeric capsule? Can I, you know, take these keto muffins and like lose weight? You know, we get so excited with all these news outlets and what we're seeing on social media, when it's like, what we were told as kids still holds true. And we see a significant underconsumption, especially in fruit, which to me is crazy because fruit is sweet and delicious. But, and again, I think some of these inaccurate trends as, you know, you should fear the sugar in fruit, can only push, you know, people, if they already aren't eating fruit and they see a headline that says that, it's confirmation bias, you know? Yeah. And so it's like, okay, I guess I should keep not eating fruit. And so that's definitely things people agree on. And also fiber intake, you know, we, in the public, you know, when you talk to your friends and stuff like that, it's protein, protein, protein. Most people, and when I say most, I mean over like 95% are getting their protein limits. No one is out here being protein deprived unless they're malnourished, which that's a whole different thing. But on the flip side, over 95% are not getting the recommended intake of fiber. Whoa. And why is this important? For it blows my mind, you know, even in medical school, it's been kind of frustrating because they'll be like, oh, you know, vegans, make sure they get their B12 shot, like, oh, make sure they get their complete protein, which is like pairing two different proteins together. Because that's a lot easier. And unfortunately, in medical school, we've seen similar trends because at the end of the day, we are being tested consistently. And so if you're presenting more gray areas, it's hard to test, right? And unfortunately, on the flip side of that, we all live in the gray area, right? That's where we all are. And that's not being necessarily reflected. But this underconsumption of fiber that we see literally, I mean, globally for the most part, but significantly in the United States is really concerning. But here's the thing is that it's kind of, it's less acute. You know, people want to go on keto because they'll lose weight within the month. But people aren't really as pushed to go to fiber when it'll prevent colon cancer down the road. You know, which I've already been super nerdy about the gut microbiome, and we just finished our GI unit, which is perfect timing for this podcast. But the beautiful thing about the gut, which is significantly positively impacted by fiber, is that it is not just a tube to transport your food. most of your immune system is in your gut. There are areas called care patches. I'm not joking. I heard some people on podcasts saying this. I'm like, that's interesting. But then we learned about it and I was like, wait a second, this is what they're talking about. You know, because at the end of the day, that makes sense, right? Your immune system wants to fight off foreign bodies. Where are you getting most of the environment? In your GI tract. So when you think about it that way, it makes so much sense. Also, serotonin release is
I was
going to
say,
yes.
I learned this recently and it blew my mind that the majority of your serotonin receptors, which is a mood regulating neurotransmitter, is not in the brain, but in the gut, which when I learned that, it made so much sense why how you're eating and digesting has such a powerful impact on your mood.
Yeah. So when people talk about this gut brain connection, it really is legit. And I know it can seem really confusing. And so that's why I think social media is also really beneficial, is that for me personally, it's pushed me to take some of these more nuanced, complex topics and think, how can I share this to the general public in a way that will make it make sense? Because if you just told someone your immune system is in your gut, like in your colon, they're just going to look at you like, okay. But then again, you think about, okay, your immune system is set up to protect you. How are you getting most environment? It's through your gut. And fiber, as we understand, really plays a massive, massive role, which that should be exciting, right? Because this is one of those, you know, seemingly simple nutrition things. And when I say simple, I mean, you know, kind of like a yes, no thing. Yes, we all should be increasing our fiber intake. That benefits so many things, your mood, your immune system. Everyone's like immune this, immune that. Get the fiber in. But here's the thing, another part, is that when you have research over fiber, you can't sell a product. You can't sell a company. You're telling people to eat oats that are like 50 cents in your natural grocery store. And so there's a lack of resources in the sense of money in these studies, because who's really benefited from it? I mean, the entire population, if you ask me, but that doesn't sell. And that's not what a lot of people's goals are. And that's where you get the money from. So just another thing to keep in mind in regard to research.
Yeah, I've had several people point that out in books and in interviews, that it's no coincidence that eat your vegetables isn't trendy news material, because to your point, there's no one that profits from that conclusion. There's no one company that has a monopoly on vegetables, thankfully. I read a study, it's like, oh great, I should eat more fiber, and I go out and buy a variety of stuff. I get turnips and rutabagas and lettuce and celery root and all this stuff, and to make a lovely plant-based meal for myself. No one company is profiting off that, so they're never going to drive the research that's like, you should eat this way. However, if you do the opposite of like, okay, we should all eat more milk, and here's a study, or drink more milk, showing that milk is great, or dairy products are great, or that we're not getting enough protein, but if you have my protein supplement, you'll get enough protein. That is a very easy way to check the box and profit. And I think if you look at like the ad budget, or especially like the lobbying budget when it comes to big like chemical agro food complex versus just eating fruits and vegetables, it's comically disproportionate. You know, we're spending so much more money telling people to drink Coca-Cola than we are to say, hey, actually sugary sodas aren't that great. Just, you know, eat a piece of fruit instead.
Yes, do not get me started on lobbying. That was actually another thing that got me interested in this path was, you know, we think about free will and we think about making choices when there are so many huge, rich organizations put in place to put out marketing to sway your opinion. And guess what? They have people who understand psychology. They have people who understand this and that. And so they are taking so much resources, because they have it, and when I say resources, kind of money, to sway opinions and to sway what people buy. And so it was interesting. I was talking to a friend about this and she didn't quite understand my point. She was like, people should just make their own decisions. Like, why are you trying to do this? But I'm like, it kind of begs the question, are people making their own decisions? You know, if they maybe don't have access to fresh food, if maybe tobacco companies are particularly targeting certain communities, how much of that choice is actually their own? You know what I mean? And there's so many forces that just, they want you to make the choice that they want you to make, but it's not always as obvious, especially when it's been around for so long.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try this one out on you. I grew up during the age of the Got Milk campaign, and it was only as an adult that I realized that wasn't like an upswelling of actual nutritional research that said, oh, it turns out milk is great for you. It was a deliberate lobbying campaign by the American Dairy Association or something like that, right? Like, it wasn't, science didn't just say, oh, milk is great, actually, everyone should drink milk. It was that the dairy industry decided we should find a way to sell more milk. Let's fund a study that finds that milk is good, and then we'll do a whole campaign with celebrities with milk mustaches.
That actually brings up a really good point. In middle school, which I didn't even know this was a path I was going to take, I actually wrote a paper called Got Facts, and it totally went through all these claims that these things made, which is so funny because I don't think at the time this is where it would end up, but that's definitely been on my radar for a long time. It actually, from my understanding, it got to a point where legally they can't actually call milk healthy. And it's really fascinating, yeah, which I won't get too into, but yeah. In terms of just like titles, but, and I think that kind of segues us into a really important part. Significant portion of the population, particularly people of color, are lactose intolerant. Yeah. And it really is confusing and concerning from like a population standpoint of why milk is being pushed so much, why it's one of the only options in a lot of schools when we see a lot of people don't have this, which for those who don't know, there's actually an enzyme called lactase that us as humans naturally lose by around age 4 or 5, because we are designed not to consume milk past the point of, you know, this prime development. There is a mutation that is commonly seen more in, the non-people color, more white community, where they are able to process it. And so that kind of brings up a point. It's like, okay, how is this chronic consumption of a component that so many of us can't properly digest, how is that going to impact us? And, you know, obviously I'm not a GI doctor yet. There is one that I really admire. And so many of her clients have, so many of their GI issues have gone away because of drinking milk. Obviously anecdotal, I had a similar experience. You know, I had dairy products and I had some really, really bad stomach issues, which actually I'm not even going further because I think anecdotal evidence is not beneficial to people to listen to. But long story short, we are not designed as humans and most mammals to continue to have milk, because at the end of the day, what is milk? If you think about it, it is a high nutrient substance for a particular mammal to develop into their adult stage. Yeah. You know, it really is not, if you really break down it to the skeleton, designed to be in their lives until, it's like thinking about, you know, an adult with like a baby bottle. Like that image is so unnatural, but we've just rebranded it. And we have, like, as you mentioned, a huge financial, you know, gains to have by keep pushing this out. And so I'll get off my milk soapbox, but that to me is really interesting, especially when you consider how many communities are more prone to not being able to digest this properly.
Yeah, no, 100%. So we've talked about social media a couple times now, and I think a lot of us learn about health and nutrition and increasingly even the news through social media. And one part of nutrition I think is important to unpack is who really is an expert. And you've kind of alluded to this a couple times now, that, I mean, one sign is if they have a really strong opinion about something, it's pretty likely they haven't actually dug into the research, because the research is rarely that strong. But one thing I want to break down is this idea of like nutritionist versus dietitian, because you have a lot of self-proclaimed nutrition experts, especially on Instagram. I feel like everyone that goes to yoga and has a smoothie is suddenly a nutrition expert these days. So I'm curious, what is the difference between a nutritionist and a dietitian?
This is an extremely important topic because words matter. And especially when so many people are able to have a voice and a platform nowadays, it can get kind of concerning. So let's break it down. Nutritionists and dietitian, first of all, are not the same thing. They're absolutely not the same thing. They can overlap, but they're not the same thing. And so dietitian is the only term of the two that's actually protected. And so what protected means is that you cannot call yourself a dietitian, an RD, whatever, unless you do a specific amount of things. And this is school for a long time. This is specific dietetic internships that are just hours and months of your life. And you have to pass exams to be able to have the RD after your name. Same with MD. You know, not everyone can just call themselves a physician, you know, an MD. You have to hit X amount of steps to do that. A dietitian has to do that. It is protected. And anyone who is an RD, it's pretty safe overall. Of course, there's going to be exceptions, to assume that they have spent years of their life getting very proper training in nutrition.
Yeah.
Nutritionists, on the other hand, is not protected whatsoever.
Yeah.
My grandma could start an Instagram account and post avocado toast and call herself a nutritionist. Huh. That's it. That being said, I want to emphasize, you know, I have friends who are nutritionists. There is a spectrum. But because there is a spectrum, it's important to kind of inquire whoever you are following, whoever you are taking advice from, where do they fall on the spectrum? Are you my grandma who made an Instagram post and called herself a nutritionist yesterday? Or, you know, there are certificate classes, there are a lot of different programs people can go through, some accredited, some kind of sketchy. And so it's really important to understand that nutritionist can mean anything, can literally mean anything.
Yeah.
And not to say that those who claim as some who claim nutritionists don't have good information, they do, but it's important to note that there is a really big spectrum, and to really find out if you're taking very strong advice or taking advice that could be potentially life-changing, make sure you know where they're coming from. That's really what I recommend. And then to note, because the general public is familiar with the term nutritionist, dietitians often also call themselves nutritionists so that people understand, you know, what it is that they do. And so that's kind of where it becomes gray area, which I don't blame them, right? You know, and so basically it's kind of like square rectangle.
Yeah.
Dietitians are nutritionists, but nutritionists are absolutely cannot be assumed to be dietitians. And I think that's really valuable. Again, when so many people have a platform and have a voice, it's good to know just where they're coming from. Again, you can have life experience, but that's the thing. If you do something and it works for you, that's called a case study. Like, that is one person. That what happens for you, again, you might be in a different financial situation, stress situation, family situation, genetics is like, you're definitely in a different genetic situation.
Yeah.
And so if one person happens to do X diet for 3 years and it works for them, I promise that does not mean much, because that is one person's experience. And so they could call themselves a nutritionist because they've been following it. But I just urge people, again, be skeptical.
Yeah. A little bit of healthy skepticism goes a long way, it sounds like. Thank you for unpacking that. That's big. A theme here I'm seeing is that on social media, when it comes to diet and nutrition, everything is not as it seems. So it's good to have that critical eye and to want to dig a little bit deeper, which is obviously counter. That's counter to how the feed works, where it just wants you to like scroll, like, and just keep going. However, real inquiry into this stuff will take some time. You know, another disconnect you've talked about in your feed that I think is really interesting and important is the nutrition community on social media is overwhelmingly white, while ironically, dietary disease disproportionately affects minority communities. What causes this disconnect, do you think?
That's an important thing to unpack, and understandably so, it's very complex. One, I think, is kind of the snowball effect, is that those who are in positions of success, unfortunately, oftentimes build up their white counterparts. You know, it's pretty unfortunate. I looked at, I'm not going to say names, two really, like, some of the biggest health podcasters, and I looked at their guests, and I don't think I saw a single person of color. Mm-hmm. And that was really concerning, because again, if you are not building up these voices, if you're not building up representation, you are missing vital perspectives that, because at the end of the day, when race impacts much of life, it naturally impacts your food choices, your culture, food choices, you're missing out. And then you're also, when you don't have representation with this snowball effect, you know, you are telling people that this isn't meant for you. And whether that's conscious or subconscious, I think that makes sense. If you are constantly bombarded with white faces being associated to this field of nutrition, for those who aren't in it, that might translate to, okay, this is a white person thing. This is a privileged thing, which I think kind of leads me to the next thing, is that nutrition, I kind of think, is naturally in a place of privilege. And that has some really negative effects on social media, particularly when people make demonized food. Mm. And when they say really strong claims like, never eat refined bread. And it's like, okay, cool. I see where you're coming from. That you have a good point, but communities may have more or less of choices in the food that they can even select in the first place. And so when you are saying these, never eat this, always eat that, if someone who, which we know on a very, you know, national level, that especially Black communities have a very unfortunate disparity when we see access to produce and grocery stores, and this is by the census, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, if you're telling someone that they have to eat flax seeds every single day and their local gas station or liquor store or whatever is nearby doesn't have them, that's going to translate, okay, the message that this person is saying is not meant for me, is not meant for my community. And of course, this is general. There are those who are white in lower socioeconomic classes. It's a lot of different things, but I really do think the snowball effect and the representation is really important. Even people that I look up to, I constantly see white voices boosting and supporting other white voices. And I think that's kind of a natural human thing, unfortunately, but it is something that we see.
Yeah. I appreciate you talking about the who you're boosting angle, because I think that's really important. We've actually kind of come full circle with this. It's interesting. Our first podcast guest ever was this amazing woman, Davida, who runs the Healthy Maven account, blog, nutrition thing. She recently ended her podcast for exactly this reason. And in her final episode, she said, wow, I'm taking a step back from the wellness podcast space because I think it's too white. And it's white people talking about white trends and fancy things that just proportionally only white people can afford. And I think the space would be better off with me kind of taking a knee for this moment and kind of silencing myself and listening and learning and letting other people have a platform and have this bandwidth and have access to my listeners. And I thought that was such a profound step for her to take that really reflects this overall moment in this trend you're talking about of just look at who is getting amplified and look at who has these platforms for now. And it's overwhelmingly white voices for sure. And then the other, I mean, I'm so glad you brought up food deserts, because I just think this needs more attention, is that, yeah, like saying everyone should be eating chia seed smoothies is great if you have a Whole Foods in your area, if you like chia seeds, and if you can afford all of these fancy smoothies. But if your neighborhood doesn't have those things, or it's not just not up your alley, then that can feel really alienating. Like suddenly you're left out of what is considered health, which is not just unhealthy, but psychologically, that's really damaging to be like, oh, so I'm not healthy because I can't or won't eat this way. Like that's, I'm just thinking through that in my head. And like, that's, we're sending a really bad message that way.
That is an extremely important point. And one of the things that I'm so grateful for in my culinary medicine class, which for those who don't know, is just a phenomenal option that certain medical schools have to teach future physicians cooking and nutrition, is that you have to meet people where they're at.
Yeah.
Because if not, you're going to miss them. And a lot of people in these wellness communities, they're where they're at, quote unquote, is a couple blocks from a Whole Foods, or like not having financial stresses of, you know, where is my next meal coming from? You know, if, and again, we do see trends. It's not all or nothing. And it's like, if where you're at is fast food every day, and maybe that's because you have to work multiple jobs, maybe you are stressed and the idea of cooking, maybe you really need to unwind, maybe there's, you know, struggles in your home life. When we make these bold claims about like fast food should kill you, like will kill you, fast food will kill you, you're being lazy if you're doing it. Yeah. How does that translate? It makes people feel hopeless in that they just don't even have the option to try. And yeah, that is where we get into a trend that is so toxic mentally, but also from a population standpoint, it gets us nowhere. And yeah, these really judgy comments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even unfortunately, some of these, you know, companies and organizations that I admire, you know, we'll see these images of these morbidly obese, you know, unattractive figures surrounded by potato chips and fast food. And it's like, who really responds to that? Because the message I'm getting is that I should, what, look down on those people, that they want to feel that way. I think that's a really big thing, especially in healthcare, is that somehow people just don't even want to. And
yeah,
that's really a narrow view in a very wide, a complex, multifactorial issue that we're seeing.
Yeah. And ultimately that we're not going to change minds and get anywhere by shaming people, it seems like, is one of the big takeaways here.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize, you know, when I was a baby vegan, when I got super into nutrition, I honestly thought that way. It really was this kind of initial, like, I think I just got so blinded by excitement and I had so much tunnel vision because the voices I was listening to were these, a privilege, even though I was a college student. It's not like I was rolling in the dough or anything, and the sad part is that I actually found myself in a really toxic mental place with food that I am now having to unlearn. No one is immune to this. And if you are not considering the stress aspect of it, you're missing a significant portion of quote unquote healthy living. Or something that I like to say is that people, especially in the wellness community, use this term holistic health. And I really beg people to challenge that term holistic. Holistic should mean how race impacts your eating decisions, how culture, how your community, socioeconomic status, mental health status, family situation. That to me is holistic. And if you aren't going to look at this full picture, then you're missing out and your message is only for a very specific group of people. And to me, that's a shame because that results in multiple communities and people feeling left out and not getting some of this phenomenal information.
Well said. If I can attempt to paraphrase, it's that when you're talking about holistic health, it's not just going to the yoga class and doing the meditation and eating the chia seed smoothie. It's also what are the other financial, social, economic circumstances that allow you to do those things or prevent you or discourage you from doing those things. It's a bigger picture.
A really big point that I like to bring up is people talk about get X amount of exercise a day. Okay, what if you live in an apartment building and it's not safe to walk around? Mm. Or the only time you can walk around is at night and you don't feel safe. Yeah. And so it's like some of this advice is just not meant for everyone. And that's why I believe it is so important to have more representation in this field, because I believe that as humans, we're naturally going to consider our own. We're going to consider these different circumstances, and that will allow us to reach more people. And I think, as we mentioned, we are seeing a lot of these chronic illnesses, these lifestyle eating behavior illnesses, disproportionately impact communities of color. And I believe that, representation is one of the many ways, but also is to understand that there's a huge history of mistrust in the medical community. And I think that in some ways is reflected into, you know, dietitians and stuff like that. And for good reason, you know, we have very documented reasons for certain communities to not maybe feel as comforted. Not only that, but doctors or those in healthcare, they're not immune to societal norms and discrimination. Mm. And some of these are unfortunately reflected, which can only further some of this mistrust. Of course, you know, I want people to trust the healthcare system. It's not perfect. Nothing is perfect. Yeah. But it's just, there's so many different layers. And so when you try and give advice that's black and white, you're just naturally missing a lot of these layers. And I think it's a shame. And I think that there really needs to be a rebranding of the online wellness community, in my opinion.
Well said, powerful words. And, you know, I would add that you are part of this effort. You're part of this change. So kudos to you for being part of a vision of a more inclusive, and I think nuanced is really important, a more nuanced vision of wellness. I think that's awesome. I think it's a sign of good things to come that people like you are out there encouraging people to do more research, frankly, and be a bit more of an empathetic, nuanced thinker. I think that's a force that this world sorely needs right now, especially when it comes to health. I want to wrap us up here with kind of doing the inverse. We've been talking about a lot of big stuff. I now want to kind of pivot it to you, not to say, you know, your life story and nutritional choices are universal, but just to explore a little bit about your life and your decisions and how you have internalized some of what you've learned about health and nutrition in your own routine. So I'm gonna hit a couple fun closer questions here to get to know you and your eating patterns a bit better. So first one here, as a medical student, I bet you've got a really slammed busy schedule. So I'm curious, what are some of your go-to meals and what are some tips you have for fitting healthy eating into a busy schedule?
A huge tip that I have that I learned very early on is to find meals that can be in one container that can, and that tastes good heated up. Y'all, not everything tastes good heating up. You have to learn that. You know, I had these elaborate taco salads, like some parts are cold, we have the dressing, all this other stuff, and it just doesn't work. Give me a one pot chili. Let's get some kale in there, sweet potato, put in with some quinoa that I can microwave at the same time or heat up on my stove. Let's go. Let's get it. You know, I think it's really important that some meals just don't translate to a busy lifestyle. You know, that complex smoothie might be great in the week when you have time. But if you have this, you know, inaccurate expectation of being able to make these elaborate meals on a day-to-day basis, you're going to end up feeling like a failure, but you're not. That's how everyone is. That's how a busy schedule is. And so you really have to plan out your meals, in my opinion. Find meals that taste good heated up. Find meals that taste good unfrozen, you know, thawed out.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me personally, a tofu scramble is a good go-to. I like to take something and put it in lots of different forms. So you can eat that with roasted potatoes on the side. You can put it in a taco. You can put it in a grain bowl. You know, it's kind of like some of these things might seem kind of like, oh, it's so boring, same thing every time. Sometimes I put different veggies in it. You know, I think it's good to have a base that you're familiar cooking with. Yeah. And then you can kind of just spice it up each week or each day to really make sure that you don't get bored. Because at the end of the day, we don't want to get bored when we're eating, right? Food is beautiful. Food should be fun and nutritious. So that and like a really good fiber heavy bean chili are some of my go-tos.
Yeah. I want to talk about tofu for a sec because we recently did a poll on our Insta stories and we said, what questions do you have about plant-based proteins? And one of the top questions we got was, how the heck do I make tofu taste good? So I want to hear from you. It sounds like you cook a lot of tofu. How do you make it taste delicious?
Yeah, so I really recommend a tofu scramble, especially if you're a newbie, because some of the things that can be kind of daunting is pressing tofu. And that's basically the process in which you try and get the water out of it. So it's like better to cook. And if you don't, it can be kind of spongy. So for me personally, sometimes I get a little lazy. I find a tofu scramble, the water naturally evaporates out as you crush it down. Mm-hmm. You know, make sure you're getting that nutritional yeast in it. If you want the eggy flavor, there's this type of black salt that like makes it eggy. I tried it for the first time this past week. It's magical. It like almost in a weird way makes it, and it's just a salt. And so look into that. But I really recommend, you know, I do mushrooms, garlic, onion, peppers, and just anything you like on that. Or maybe if you're not familiar with it, get a nice dairy-free or non-dairy-free cheese sauce, drizzle that on there. I really think that, or kind of like you would use scrambled eggs, I think doing a tofu scramble with roasted potatoes in a breakfast taco, hello, yum. Delicious. It's really hard to go wrong as long as you're cooking it all out and the texture isn't too spongy. Some other ways I recommend is to press it and marinate and bake, which again, it's kind of a process. So that's kind of why I opt for tofu scramble, because I can kind of just let it go. I just let the heat evaporate, and y'all, there's like hundreds of tofu scrambles recipes now. You can find which one you have the ingredients for. It's beautiful. So that is my recommendation for go-to, or definitely marinating and baking it, because that helps with texture and flavor.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. You've been vegan for over 7 years, as I understand it. What advice do you have for people that are either trying to go vegan, or let's say they're just a little bit, call it plant curious. They want to eat more plant-based, but they're kind of intimidated. What advice do you have for them?
I love this question. I think one of the biggest things is to not get bogged down into labels. You know, kind of similarly, it's so sexy to like call yourself vegan or vegetarian, but really whatever your goal is, whether that's the ethical side, whether that's environmental or health-wise, any movement down the spectrum to becoming more vegan or more plant-based, you're going to be benefiting whatever your why is. And again, you know, it's super fun to put vegan in your profile, and yet if you were 90% vegan or plant-based or something like that, you're going to get so many benefits. Or say you want to do vegan for one day, you don't necessarily need to become 100%. You don't need the label. I get it. The label is fun. But I really recommend just not putting so much emphasis on that, because I think you're going to end up being unsatisfied. And kind of similarly to go with that, know your why. Don't do it because it's trendy. Don't do it because your friend's doing it. When we think about things being sustainable, which, you know, at the end of the day, and that's one of the things most people agree on, that incorporating the more amount of plants, or as I say, more plants, less problems. You know, it really,
that's kind of a little quotes. I want that on a t-shirt.
I actually keep an eye out. I might be doing that. You know, know your why is really important. And then last thing I'd like to recommend is don't think you have to eat completely different food. I think that's a huge daunting thing people have because, again, you might, maybe your wellness person that you follow on Instagram, maybe their culture is different. Maybe their financial situation is different. Just because, you know, if they make some lettuce cups that don't look appealing to you, don't tell yourself, oh, guess I can't be vegan. No, I really recommend, okay, you like tacos. Let's find a vegan taco recipe. You like spaghetti. Yeah. How can we swap out that meat for either like Texas soy protein or some lentils or some veggies? You know, I really recommend not getting afraid of like, I need to completely change my eating behaviors, but how can I tweak them to just have some more plants in it? I think that's a really big trap that I think a lot of people fall in, and they can easily get bogged down because they think they aren't a failure. But if you were trying to tell anyone to change their eating habits in like a snap of a finger, like no one can really do that unless they have like a professional chef, which I'm jealous of that person. It's not me. you know, the great thing about the internet, y'all, there are recipes galore. There are too many recipes if you ask me. So really kind of take what you love and type in, you know, vegan burger, vegan, you know, fried rice, you know, mm-hmm. there's so many different options. So don't think you have to eat a completely new diet just because you want to incorporate more plants. How do we change the ratios? How do we swap some things out? I think is a really good advice I have for people.
Yeah. I mean, advice you hear a lot for dealing with other people making changes, like meet them halfway. And it's interesting. It seems like a corollary. What you're saying is meet yourself halfway. Don't ask yourself to make some huge revolutionary change. I mean, it's the same with exercise. Like if you're not a long distance runner, it would be ludicrous to say the best way for you to get in shape, Brooklyn, is to do a long distance run. You know, if you would rather do dance or yoga or rowing or weightlifting or whatever works for you, it would be really unhelpful for me to be like, hey, Brooklyn, you really need to do long distance runs. And ironically, I think a lot of us get stuck in that with diet. Where it's like, well, I see the smoothies and I see the kale bowl. So I guess that's the only way I can eat vegan is these smoothies and this kale bowl. When, to your point, we're drowning in awesome resources on the internet for recipes. So however you want to eat, there is a healthy version. There's a plant version. There is a vegetarian version, a vegan version. All of it exists. You just got to find a way to kind of meet yourself where you're at. I think that's a really empowering starting point you've given us. Final question about your lifestyle and routine I'm curious to unpack is you talk a lot about mental health on your feed, which I think is awesome because that's often left out of the conversation around health. And we're in a trying year here in 2020 for a lot of reasons. We've talked about some of them, you know, a reckoning around race and racism, coronavirus, in addition to the day-to-day stressors of life. So how have you found, or what practices have you found helpful to really stay grounded and reduce stress during a particularly stressful year?
For me personally, I find that movement, completely separate from wanting to lose weight, is so underrated. Again, people, I hear this common narrative, like I'm not trying to lose weight, I don't need to exercise. Exercise objectively makes you happier. We see this time and time again in research, and y'all, I get it. When I was not feeling good, not exercising, and people told me it was good for mental health, I was like, you crazy, like you were just trying to show us your abs, whatever. No, y'all, if you move for the sake of moving, for the sake of being happy, you're going to find benefit that you've never understood. And so for me personally, I, like you mentioned, I love dancing. Love dancing. And again, this is tricky depending on your environment. And it kind of goes back to this idea of what is sustainable for you. You know, long distance running, if you have asthma, is not sustainable for you. I mean, some people can work on it, but we're not getting into that. So really figure out what makes you happy and just understand is that, you know, for me personally, like I'm trying to get more into meditation, all this other stuff. The beautiful thing about movement is that your body, like at a snap of a finger, it just knows to release these endorphins and you're going to feel happier short term. And so that's why I think it's important for everyone to benefit because there are amazing long-term options, but sometimes you don't see those results in a while. That's kind of the nature of the brain. Another thing that I personally have been trying to do is to really prioritize meaningful relationships. You know, we hear that in social media we're connected more than ever, and yet we're feeling lonelier than ever. And I think that this really needs to be talked about more. How can we prioritize relationships that, you know, make us feel fulfilled, make us feel loved, make us feel satisfied? Because that is really the core of moving forward, being happy, being productive, making some of these happier choices when we are feeling satisfied mentally. And so it's like, okay, cool, you can connect with hundreds hundreds of people online, but are those really going to make you feel fulfilled? And so this is something I'm learning. I also started therapy and we're working through that too. And I really recommend, you know, get rid of the stigma. We all are dealing with mental health issues. We are literally all dealing with it. And the sooner we all understand that, the sooner hopefully we can understand we are in this together. How can we build each other up? And so make sure you're prioritizing that. And then last thing, my cats. I love them so much. That's it.
Shout out to the cats. If you're listening, cats, you're very appreciated. No, thank you. I don't mean to jest. That was a really, really sincere and awesome answer. I really appreciate that. Definitely agree. Time to move past the stigma and take mental health seriously. The stakes are too high not to. To our earlier discussion about, you know, health is everything, really. Two final questions here to wrap us up. First one is, what's a change you've made in the past year in your life that you think folks should try?
A change that I've made is kind of recognizing the ever-present harms of diet culture. And so this is something that really has come to my attention that, you know, again, the models that we see on TV, the companies that want to sell us products, this is all rooted in this culture, quote unquote, that prioritizes weight and figure and appearances. And when you can really take a step back and realize how much of this possibly has impacted you, you know, we see that children, I don't even want to say how young of ages, start dieting, not because they want to feel good or prevent, you know, cardiovascular disease. It's because they want to look a certain way. The grasp of diet culture start early and they start strong. And if we can recognize that it is everywhere and has likely impacted our relationship with food, our relationship with our bodies, it really kind of gives you the power back. And I think that's really beautiful. And I think that, you know, people will talk about diet culture. I think everyone should understand the importance of that. And so having that on the top of my mind personally, as, you know, a female in America who has likely also been impacted by this, has really just helped my relationship with food and people and my body. And at the end of the day, if those are good things that you have to embrace every single day, imagine how much more you can get done. So that's definitely a change that I've implemented in my mind, I suppose. And it's been really beneficial.
Awesome. And finally here, Brooklyn, what are you grateful for this week?
I am grateful for good, cool weather in Texas, which is rare. I love being able to do stuff outside. I am grateful for delicious food because it makes me very happy. And I'm just grateful for different opportunities that I've been able to have via connections with other people or just hard work. It really is amazing to keep the door open and just figure out, you know, what are the opportunities you have out there? How can we take advantage of so many things in our lives? And so I've been really grateful for that because there's just things that have gone on through this medical track that I would have never dreamed of. And that's really been amazing to me.
Awesome. Brooklyn Palmer, this has been such a great chat. Thank you so much for joining us today. Where can folks learn more about you and the work that you do?
Yeah, so I am primarily on Instagram, Beats by Brooke, the food beats, I always like to say. So that is my prime outlet. I'm trying to branch out, but y'all, it's a little hard with medical school, but that's mostly where you can find me. I try to be as responsive as possible, and I try and put on a wide range of different topics to really just share what I've learned through life and through medical school.
Awesome. We'll have links to that as well as everything we talked about today in the show notes. That'll live on our content site, thewholecarrot.com. That's so you can find this podcast and all of our podcast episodes. So definitely check out The Whole Carrot when you have a second. Brooklyn Palmer, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation.
Thanks for having me.